about the infallibility of the Pope, about Mike. Thankfully, she had not gotten wind of his Buddhism experiment. My mother did not typically have an unarticulated thought, and now she was all but silent. It was not a good sign. I couldn't muster the energy or the courage to ask her again about Dominic, or bring up the matter of my father's pipe. Cat called almost every day. "Are you two still alive over there?" she'd ask. "Maybe I ought to come check on you." I would reassure her we were fine. I didn't want company, and she picked up on that. Hugh called also, but only once. The phone rang 2 or 3 days after I'd sat in the mermaid chair and felt the floodgates open. Mother and I were watching a bobsled race. The first words out of Hugh's mouth were, "Let's not fight." He wanted me to apologize for before. I could tell. He waited patiently. "I don't want to fight either." That's all I could manage. He waited some more. After a pointed sigh, he said, "I hope you've thought it over and changed your mind about my coming." "I haven't changed my mind at all," I said. "I still think I should do this by myself." It sounded harsh, so I tried to soften it up. "Try to understand it from my side, okay?" He said automatically, "Okay," but I knew he wouldn't. That's one of the worst things about living with brilliant people. They're so used to being right, they don't really have experience being anything else. A blinding white tiredness came over me as we talked. I didn't mention Dominic and how I suspected he was involved somehow, because Hugh would have dissected it half to death. He would have told me how to proceed. I wanted to navigate by my own instincts. "When are you coming home?" Hugh wanted to know. Home. How could I tell him that at this moment I had an unbearable need to flee it? I had an urge to say, "Please, I want to be alone with my life right now, to go down into my nautilus shell and see what's there." But I didn't say anything. I was driven by a deep, sickening selfishness, and that same discontent I'd felt back at home, but also by a kind of sorrowing love for myself. My life seemed sweet and dull and small and repellent, so much of it unused. The last few days, I'd been thinking about the life I'd meant to live, the one that had shone in my head a long time ago, full of art and sex and mesmerizing discussions about philosophy and politics and God. I'd owned my own gallery in that non-existent life. I'd painted surrealistic works full of startling, dreamlike imagery. There'd been a moment a couple of years earlier when I might have reached for that life, at least for a little piece of it. 2 days before Christmas, I'd crawled into a storage space beneath a dormer to retrieve my good china, a fine-boned Lennox pattern that had been discontinued and was thus irreplaceable. It was packed and stored in boxes, brought out for major holidays and the occasional wedding anniversary. Dee saw me and knew instantly what I was doing. "Mom," she said, "why don't you use it more often? What are you saving it for?" Her voice was full of what I recognized instantly as pity. "Yes. What indeed?" I didn't know, couldn't begin to say. My own funeral, perhaps. Dee would throw a wake, and people would stand around talking about how outstanding it was that I still had a complete 12-piece set after all these years. What a tribute. For days after that, I'd been deflated by my own shrunken world. When had my fear of broken plates gotten so grandiose? My desire for extravagant moments so small? After that, I'd made room for the china in one of the kitchen cabinets and used it indiscriminately. Because it was Wednesday, because someone had purchased one of my art boxes, because it appeared that on Cheers, Sam was finally going to marry Diane. It hadn't gone much beyond china, though, that good impulse toward largeness. As I held the phone, I wanted to tell Hugh about it, the dormer and the china, but I wasn't sure it made any sense.
Jesse, Hugh was saying, did you hear me? When are you coming home?
I can't possibly know when I'll come home. Not yet. I could be here, I don't know, a long time.
I see.
I think he did see, too. He saw that my being on the island was about more than taking care of Mother. It was about the disquiet I'd felt all winter. It was about me, about us. But he didn't say that. He said,
Jesse, I love you.
This will come out sounding terrible, but I felt he said it to test me, to see if I would say it back to him. I'll call you in a few days, I said. When we hung up, I watched the window silver over with water, then walked back to the living room to Mother and the TV and the bobsled race. About 4 o'clock every afternoon, I would smell night coming. It would curl under the doors and windows, a wet black smell. Wanting Thomas was worse at night. I began to take long, involved baths at the first graying shade of darkness. I pilfered one of the emergency candles from Mother's old hurricane box and set it on the ledge of the tub. I lit it, then made the water as hot as I could stand, until the room swirled with steam. I often sprinkled cedar leaves from the backyard onto the water, or a handful of salt, or spoonfuls of Mother's lavender oil, as if I were creating a brew. The fragrance was sometimes overpowering. I would slide down into it with only my nostrils sticking out. You would think I'd only now discovered water, its hot, silky feel. Submerged, I would go off into a dreamy state. I had always loved Chagall's Lovers in the Red Sky, his painting of an entwined couple soaring above rooftops, above the moon. The image would come to me each time I sank into the water. The couple sometimes flying through a red sky, but more often swimming in searing blue water. Other times I would think of the mermaid Chagall had painted, suspended above the water, above the trees, a flying mermaid, but without wings, and I would think of Thomas saying he envied mermaids who belonged equally to the sea and to the sky. One night, I sat up in bed. Something was different. It was, I realized, the silence on the roof. I looked toward the window and saw that the clouds had parted. Moonlight was falling into the room like bits of mica. I got up and went plundering through the house for something, anything to draw with. I found a decrepit box of colored pencils in Mike's desk, where he must have left them 2 decades before. I stood at the kitchen table and sharpened them with a fish knife. Unable to locate anything but notebook paper, I took down the large framed picture of the Morris Island lighthouse from over the mantel, wrestled out the print, and began to sketch impatiently on the back side of it, with a ravenous kind of movement that was commanding and completely foreign to me. I covered the canvas with sweeping flows of blue water. In each corner, I drew a nautilus shell with an orange light cracking out of it, and along the bottom, turtle skulls, heaps of them, rising in columns like a sunken civilization. The lost Atlantis. In the very center, I sketched the lovers. Their torsos were pressed together, their limbs braided. The woman's hair wound around them both like May ribbons. They were flying. Waterborne. The work was exhilarating and a little scary, like driving a car and having a blowout. When I finished, I returned the lighthouse print to its frame and hung it back over the mantel, the lovers facing the wall. It was impossible to go back to sleep. I was wildly keyed up. I went into the kitchen to make tea. I was sitting at the table, sipping chamomile from a chipped mug, when I heard scratching at the door, a pronounced, deliberate sound. Flipping on the porch light, I peered out the kitchen window. Max sat on the porch, his black coat bedraggled and sodden. I opened the door. "Oh, Max, look at you." He peered up at me with questioning eyes. "All right, come on in." He was known to sleep at different homes on the island on a rotating basis, the schedule known only to him. Mother once said he showed up here every couple of months wanting a bed, but I doubted he arrived in the middle of the night. I wondered if his current landlord had turned him out. Had he seen the light on here? I pulled out the old bedspread Mother kept for him in the pantry. As he curled up on it, I sat on the floor and dried him with a dish towel. "What are you doing roaming around in the middle of the night?" I said. He pricked up his ears a little, then laid his head across my thigh. I stroked his ears, remembering what Thomas had said about Max going out in the boat with him when he did his rookery duties. "You like Brother Thomas?" I said. He thumped his tail. I imagine because of the syrup that had taken over my voice, the tone used for newborn babies, puppies, kittens. "I know. I like him, too." Rubbing Max's head worked better than the tea. The wired feeling started to ebb. "Max, what am I gonna do?" I said. "I'm falling in love." I'd come to this truth while sitting in the mermaid chair, but I hadn't said it aloud. It surprised me what a relief it was to make the confession, even to a dog. Max let out a breath and closed his eyes. I didn't know how to stop feeling what I felt, to shake the idea that here was a person I was meant to find. It was not just the man who excited me. It was the sky in him, things in him that I did not know, had never tasted, might never taste, perhaps. Right then it seemed almost easier to live with the devastation of my marriage than the regret of living my life without ever knowing him for sure, without flying through a red sky or a blue sea. "My husband's name is Hugh," I said to Max, who was by now sound asleep. "Hugh," I said again, then went on saying it in my head as a way to rescue myself. "Hugh. Hugh. Hugh." Chapter 18. On March 2nd, I rolled the golf cart out of the garage and drove over the muddy roads to the cluster of shops near the ferry. The sun had returned with the indifferent look of winter, a hard, small fire lodged high and bright. As I bumped along through the oaks, I felt like a creature emerging from underground. I wanted to pick up a few groceries at Carcar General Store and see, too, if they sold paints. I needed something besides Mike's colored pencils. Mostly, though, I wanted to talk to Cat about Brother Dominic. The ferry was docked, and a few tourists meandered along the sidewalk with their windbreakers zipped to their necks. I parked in front of Cat's gift shop, where Max sat beneath the blue and white striped awning. Cat had nailed a small mirror beside the shop door, an old gullah custom meant to scare away the booger hag. As I opened the door, Max darted into the store ahead of me. Cat, Benny, and Hepzibah sat behind the counter, eating ice cream from plastic bowls. They were the only ones in the store. "Jesse!" Benny cried. Cat smiled at me. "Welcome to the world of living, breathing people. You want some ice cream?" I shook my head. Hepzibah was wearing an ebony shift with white lightning bolts on it, and her signature matching head wrap. She looked like a beautiful thundercloud. Max plopped at Benny's feet and she patted him, cutting her eyes at me. "Mama said you've been acting rude." "Oh, for Lord's sake, Benny, do you have to repeat every damn thing I say?" "You think I've been rude?" I asked, wanting to tease her, but a little miffed, too. She grinned. "Well, what do you call it when a person phones you every single day saying, 'Can I come visit? Can I bring you dinner? Can I come over and kiss your feet?
And all this person gets back is, "We're fine, thank you. Go away now."
I didn't say go away now, and I don't recall you asking to kiss my feet. If you'd like, though, you can do that now.
For some reason, whenever I got around Kat, I started behaving like her.
"Aren't we testy?" she said.
Of course, if I'd been cooped up with Nell Dubois for 2 weeks, I'd be lobbing grenades at people.
I glanced around the shop for the first time. Tables and wall shelves brimmed with a bewildering array of items with mermaids on them. Keychains, beach towels, greeting cards, embossed soaps, bottle openers, paperweights, nightlights. There were mermaid dolls, mermaid comb and mirror sets, even mermaids to hang on the Christmas tree. The mermaid crossing signs were stuck in an umbrella stand in the corner, and a dozen mermaid wind chimes dangled from the ceiling. In the center of the store was a table arranged with a pile of Father Dominic's booklets, The Mermaid's Tale, with a sign declaring them special autographed copies.
"Pick something out," said Kat. "A gift. Some earrings or something."
"Thanks, but I couldn't."
"You're being rude again," she said.
I picked up a box of mermaid tears.
"Okay, then, I'll take this."
Benny got a folding chair for me from a closet, and I sat.
"What brings you to town?" asked Hepzibah.
"Groceries. And I thought I'd see if I could find..." I stopped, hesitant to say it out loud. The old inclination, I suppose, to keep my art confined and safe, like a potentially fractious child restricted to her room. I looked down at my hands, my palms pushed together and held in the vise of my knees.
"Art supplies," I said with an effort. I hope no one noticed.
"Watercolors, brushes, some cold press paper."
"Caw Caw sells electric hot dog cookers and chia pets, but I doubt they have art supplies," Kat said.
She reached for a pencil and paper on the counter.
"Here, write down what you want, and I'll have Shem buy it for you next time he takes the ferry over."
I jotted down the basics while their spoons scraped around for the last of the ice cream.
"I take it you're planning to stay a while, then," said Hepzibah.
"Mother needs me, so, yeah, I thought I would." Kat lifted her eyebrows.
"How long's a while?"
"I guess indefinitely," I said, wanting to get off the subject.
"What about Hugh?" she asked.
I thrust the list at her. "When you first called me, you accused me of neglecting Mother. I believe your exact words were, 'You can't go around like you don't have a mother.' And now you're accusing me of neglecting Hugh." My voice hit a high, bleating note on the word Hugh. Kat acted like I'd smacked her in the face.
"Good grief, Jessie. I don't care whether you're there taking care of Hugh. The man can take care of himself. Since when did I worry about men being taken care of by their wives? I was only wondering if everything's okay with you two."
"As if that's any of your business," Hepzibah said to her.
I couldn't imagine what Kat was picking up on.
"So tell us, how's Nell?" Hepzibah asked.
I shrugged. "To be honest, I think Mother is depressed. All she does is sit in a chair, stare at the television, and work her Rubik's Cube."
"Lunch at Max's," Kat blurted.
The dog had been snoring gently with his head on Benny's shoe, but he slitted open his eyes at the mention of his name.
"We'll all have lunch at the cafe this Saturday."
Over the years, Mother had tried to tug her thread from the knot the three of them had made and thrown into the sea that night, the one that held them together over the years. But Kat had refused to let her isolate herself. Her loyalty, and Hepzibah's too, had never wavered, not once. "That's a nice idea," I said, realizing I couldn't stay mad at Kat for more than 3 minutes. I don't know why that was. She was the most provoking woman I'd ever met. "But I doubt she'll come," I added.
"Tell her the Pope will be having lunch at Max's this Saturday. That ought to do it."
Hepzibah turned to me.
"Just tell her we've been missing her and need to see her face."
"I'll try," I said, but don't expect much. Glancing past them, I noticed the boat wreck picture I'd painted when I was 11, framed and hung over the cash register. Oh, look! There's my picture. A fiery white boat was lodged on the bottom of the ocean, along with a smiling octopus, a giant clam with peeping eyes, and a herd of rocking seahorses. It looked like a happy page from a children's book, except for the boat burning in the middle of it all. Fire beneath the water. Was that how I'd seen his death as a child? An inferno nothing could extinguish? On the serrated surface of the water, gray ashes floated like plankton. But above it, the sun smiled, and the world was a becalmed, cloudless place. I'd never noticed how much ache was inside the picture until now. A child's wish for the world to return to its perfect self. When I looked around, Hepzibah was studying me.
I remember when you made that picture. You were one sad little girl.
Cat scowled at her.
How festive of you to bring that up.
Hepzibah said,
Jessie was sad. She knows it, and we know it. So why not say it?
She'd never taken any kind of guff from Cat, which is probably why they got along so well. Why is it you never want to talk about that time? I asked Cat. I want to talk about it. I need to. I want to know, for instance, why everyone, including Mother, said it was a spark from my father's pipe that caused the fire.
Because it was a spark from the pipe that caused the fire, Cat said.
And I saw Hepzibah nod.
Well, I found this in a drawer in Mother's bedroom, I said, digging the pipe from my purse. I cupped it in my palms like a communion wafer or a butterfly with a torn wing. A smell of tobacco mixed with licorice drifted from the pipe bowl.
They stared at it without speaking, their empty ice cream bowls sitting crooked in their laps. Their faces were completely expressionless. Finally, Cat said,
What did Nell say about it?
I haven't mentioned the pipe to her yet. I'm afraid seeing it might send her over the edge again. Cat held out her hand for the pipe, and I gave it to her. She turned it over several times, as if she might divine some answer from it.
The police were just speculating when they said it was the pipe that started the fire. So it was something else. What difference does it make now?
She handed the pipe back to me.
But why would she let the police and everyone else believe that it was the pipe when she had it all along?
Why would she lie about it? I asked. Sunlight poured through the storefront window from a little spout between the clouds, and all three of them turned their faces toward the dusty brightness.
I went to see Father Dominic, I said. I sort of accused him of knowing something about Mother cutting off her finger.
You didn't, said Cat.
I did. And you know what he told me? To leave matters alone. He said that if I didn't, it could hurt Mother.
He said that? Cat stood up and walked to the counter.
This doesn't make any sense, she glanced at Hepzibah, who seemed just as mystified as Cat was.
He's hiding something, I insisted. Cat walked behind my chair. Her hands floated down onto the tops of my shoulders and rested there. When she spoke, the acerbic edge that slipped so easily into her voice was gone.
We'll figure this out, Jessie, okay? I'll talk with Dominic.
I smiled up at her, appreciatively. I could see the line along her jaw where her makeup ended. Her throat lifted as she swallowed, exposing a whole continent of tenderness in her. The moment must have grown too dear for her, because she abruptly moved her hands and changed the subject.
In exchange, you're going to have to paint some mermaid pictures for me to sell in the store.
What?
She came around and stood in front of me. You heard me. You said you were going to paint, so paint mermaids. They would sell like crazy in here. You can do it on consignment. We'll put a big price on them.
I stared at her, open-mouthed. In my head, I saw a canvas of lapis sky filled with winged mermaids flying around like angels and diving from great heights into the sea. I tried to remember what Thomas had said about mermaids with wings, something about sea muses bringing messages from below, living in two realms. Cat said,
"Well, what about it?"
"I might try it. We'll see." The tourists I'd noticed earlier wandered in now, and Cat went to greet them while Hepzibah stood, saying she had to get home. I needed to go too, but I went on sitting there with Benny, still thinking of Thomas. During the last 12 days, caged up in Mother's house, I'd told myself so many contradictory things. That I was in love, and not only that, but it was a great love, and to walk away from it would be a denial of my life. And then, alternately, that I was having an insane infatuation, that it was a heart-twisting moment in time that would eventually pass, and I had to be stoic. I didn't see why loving someone had to have so much agony attached to it. It felt like a series of fresh cuts in the skin of my heart. Benny straightened up and looked at me, squinting, the tip of her tongue resting on her bottom lip.
"Jessie," she said.
"What is it, Benny?" She scooted her chair close to mine and pushed her lips against my ear the way children do when imparting secrets.
"You love one of the monks," she whispered.
I reared back and blinked at her. "Where did you get such an idea?"
"I just know."
Refuting it to her would be pointless. Benny, of course, was never wrong. I wanted to be angry with her, to swat her for snooping around in my heart. But she rose up on her seat, smiling at me. A woman my age with the sweet mind of a child and a prodigious psychic ability. She didn't even know how dangerous truth could be, all the tiny shattering seeds it carried. "Benny," I said, taking her hand, "listen carefully. You mustn't say anything about this to anyone. Promise me?"
"But I already did."
I turned loose her hand and closed my eyes for a moment before asking, "Who?" I said. "Who did you tell?"
"Mama," she answered.
Chapter 19. A note had been slipped under the back door in the kitchen, folded inside a sealed white envelope with a single word on the front. "Jessie." I found it after I got back from Cat's shop. Picking it up, I studied the writing, a bold, slanted script, but oddly filled with hesitation, as if the writer had stopped and started several times. Some things you just know, like Benny does. I slid it into the pocket of my khakis at the same moment Mother walked into the room.
"What's that?" she said.
"Nothing," I told her. "I dropped something." I did not open it right away. I let it rest in the dark pouch along my thigh, pressing like a hand. I told myself, "First, I will call my daughter, then make tea. I will be sure Mother is situated, and then I will sit on the bed and sip the tea and open the envelope." I was an accomplished practitioner of delayed gratification. Hugh once said people who could delay gratification were highly mature. I could put off happiness for days, months, years. That's how mature I was. I learned it from eating Tootsie Roll Pops as a child. Mike would crunch through the candy shell immediately to get to the chocolate in the middle, while I licked and licked, wearing it down in an agonizingly slow process. I dialed Dee's number in her dorm at Vanderbilt and listened to her chatter about her latest escapade. Her sorority had sponsored the world's largest pillow fight. 312 people on a softball field, feathers everywhere. Apparently, the event was witnessed by a so-called scrutineer from the Guinness Book of World Records. "It was all my idea," she said proudly. "I'm sure it was," I said. "My daughter,
a world record holder. I'm very proud.
How's Gran? She asked.
She's okay, I said.
Did you find out why she did it?
She won't talk to me yet. At least not about that.
There's something she's hiding. The whole thing is complicated. Mom, I was remembering. I don't know. It's probably nothing.
What?
Tell me. It's just that one time when I visited her, a really long time ago, we were walking by that place where the slaves are buried, that cemetery, you know, and Gran totally freaked.
What do you mean, freaked?
She started crying and saying stuff.
Do you remember what she was saying?
Not really, just something about seeing a dead person's hand or fingers. I guess she was talking about the bodies in the cemetery, but she was real upset, and it kind of scared me.
You never mentioned it.
But she did crazy things like that. It was just Gran.
Dee paused, and I could hear her U2 tape playing in the background.
I should have told you. Oh, Mom, you think if I'd said something, this wouldn't have happened?
Listen to me. It wouldn't have made a bit of difference in what she did. Believe me, okay? Your Gran is sick, Dee.
Okay, she said.
After we hung up, I made peppermint tea and took a cup to the living room. There was Mother, the television, the Rubik's Cube. The Russians had won an ice skating medal, and their national anthem was like a funeral dirge weighing down the room. I set the cup on the table beside her and patted her shoulder. The episode Dee had described had only confused me more.
Are you all right? How's your hand?
Fine, but I don't like peppermint tea, she said. It tastes like toothpaste.
I closed the door to my room and turned the lock, then pulled the envelope out of my pocket. I placed it in the middle of the bed and sat down beside it. I sipped my tea and stared at it.
There was never any question I would open it. I was not trying to preserve those last moments of high and aggravated anticipation, either. The slow, excruciating pleasure of wearing down to get to the chocolate. No, I was merely terrified. I was holding Pandora's envelope.
I tore it open and pulled out a lined white paper, ragged along one edge, as if it had been torn from a journal.
Jesse, I hope I'm not being too presumptuous in writing, but I wonder if you would like to go for a ride in the John boat. The egrets aren't plentiful now, but I've spotted a colony of white pelicans, which is very rare. I'll be at the dock in the rookery tomorrow at 2 p.m., and I would be happy if you join me. Brother Thomas. Wit.
Wit. I touched the word with my finger, then said it out loud, sensing the intimacy that had gone into the act of disclosing his real name. It felt as though he'd offered a hidden part of himself to me, one the monastery did not own, and yet the note had a certain formality about it.
I would be happy if you joined me. I read it several times. I didn't realize that the teacup had turned over on the bed until I felt the wetness seep against my leg. I soaked up what I could with a towel, then lay down beside the dampness, breathing the smell of peppermint, the sweet cleanness of it drifting from the sheets like a fresh new beginning. A half-dozen seagulls squatted behind me on the dock in the rookery in perfect formation, like a small squadron of planes waiting to take off. I had come early, too early, more out of caution than eagerness. I'd reasoned that if I arrived early and felt I couldn't go through with meeting him, I could simply leave, unseen. For almost an hour, I sat cross-legged at the edge of the dock beneath the gleaming, cloudless ceiling of light and studied the water. It looked tawny, the color of mangoes and cantaloupes, and the tide was flooding in, splashing against the pilings as if the creek had lost all patience. A faded red canoe, almost pink now, lay upside down on one end of the dock, the bottom encrusted with barnacles. I recognized it as Hepzibah's. I'd been a passenger in it at least 30 years ago. On the other end, a spruce green John boat, practically new, bobbed on the water, sunlight running in hypnotic wave patterns along the side.
I heard a board creak behind me and the gulls lifted. Turning, I saw him standing on the dock, gazing at me. He wore blue jeans and a denim shirt with the sleeves rolled to his elbows. His shoulders were broader, more muscular than I'd thought they would be, and his arms had the leathery look of someone who worked in the sun. A wooden pectoral cross hung around his neck, oddly discordant with the rest of him. It was as if he'd been residing in an obscure place in my heart, and suddenly stepped out of it. A real man, but not quite real either.
"You came," he said. "I didn't know if you would."
I got to my feet. "You promised white pelicans."
He laughed. "I said I'd spotted white pelicans. I can't promise we'll see them."
He climbed into the boat and, taking my hand, helped me step down into it. For a moment, his face was close to mine. I could smell soap on his skin, starting to mingle with a slight muskiness from the warmth of the day. I sat down on the front bench, Max's seat, I imagined, facing backward, and watched as Thomas started the small outboard motor. He sat beside it as it churned the golden brown water, holding the rudder, easing us into the middle of the creek.
"Should I call you Thomas or Whit?" I asked.
"I haven't been called Whit in years. I wouldn't mind hearing it again."
"I assume your mother named you that, as opposed to the Abbot?"
"She named me John Whitney O'Connor and called me Whit."
"Okay, then. Whit," I said, trying it out.
We plied through the ebb tide delta on the backside of the island at an idle. We threaded coils in the creek so narrow and lush in places, I could almost stretch out my arms and touch the grasses on either side. We didn't try to converse any more over the engine. I think we were both trying to get comfortable with the strangeness of what was happening, of being together in a little boat disappearing into the aloneness of the marsh. He pointed to a flash of mullet, to several woodstalks lifting out of the grass, to an osprey nest perched atop a dead pine. We wound through the loops in the creek for a while, before Whit sharply veered the boat into a tributary that eventually dead-ended in a circle of water surrounded by a wall of tall grass 6 or 7 feet high. He cut the engine, and the silence and seclusion of the place welled up. I felt as though we'd passed through the eye of a tiny needle into a place that was out of time. He slid the anchor over the side.
"This is where I saw the white pelicans. I believe they're feeding near here, so if we're lucky, they'll fly over." He glanced at the sky, and I forced myself to do the same, to look away from his face. It was mottled with sunlight and a hint of beard stubble.
"What's that?" I asked, pointing to a wooden structure protruding above the brush on a tiny island some 20 or 30 yards behind him.
"Oh, that's my unofficial hermitage," he said. "It's basically nothing but a lean-to. I use it to read or just sit and meditate. I've been known to take naps in it, too. To be perfectly honest, I've probably napped in it more than I've meditated."
I clicked my tongue teasingly. "Napping on the job." I felt ridiculously light-hearted.
"My napping wouldn't surprise the Abbot, but I'm afraid the lean-to would. He isn't aware it exists."
"Why?"
"I'm pretty sure he wouldn't allow me to have it."
I liked that there was a hidden part of him he kept separate from the monastery, a tiny bit of dissidence.
"Did you know white pelicans don't dive for food like the brown ones?" he said. "They work as a team. I've seen them sit on the water in a big circle and corral the fish to the center of it. It's ingenious, really."
"I think I must be a brown pelican," I said. And the moment it left my mouth, I thought how silly it sounded, like one of those quizzes in women's magazines. "If you were a color, what color would you be if you were an animal?"
"Why do you say that?" he asked.
"I don't know. I guess because I work alone."
"I don't even know what you do."
I was not good at saying, "I'm an artist." The words tended to get lodged in my throat.
"I have an art studio," I said. "I fool around in it a little." So you're an artist, he said. I wasn't sure if anyone had ever called me that before, even you.
What medium? He asked.
I used to do a watercolor tableau thing. I don't know how to describe it.
Come on, he said. Try.
I was surprised at how badly I wanted to tell him. I closed my eyes, trying to say it as eloquently as I could. I start with a wooden box, kind of like a shadow box. I paused. I couldn't believe I'd said shadow box. God, I hated when people referred to it that way. Wait, not a shadow box. It's more like a Mexican retablo. And I paint a scene inside it. It could be a landscape, people, anything. Then I arrange things in front of the scene like it's extending out of the painting, sort of a diorama effect. I open my eyes, and I remember how I was caught by the sight of him. How handsome he looked, leaning forward with his elbows resting on his knees, listening so intently to me. In the strong light, his blue eyes were the exact color of his denim shirt.
They sound wonderful, he said.
Believe me, they are not that wonderful. I thought they were in the beginning. They started off being really satirical and quirky, but they became much more planned and... I fumbled in my head for the word. Unobjectionable, I heard myself say.
That's an interesting way to put it.
I stared at him. Everything I was saying was coming out wrong. I didn't even know what I'd meant by unobjectionable. I guess I mean art should evoke some kind of reaction in a person, not just look beautiful. It should disturb people a little.
Yeah, but look around.
He threw out an arm, gesturing at the marsh grass, the water in quiet motion, the light floating on top of it like bits of froth.
Look at this. What about beauty for the sake of beauty? Sometimes I look at the trees out here, full of egrets, or a piece of art like Bernini's The Ecstasy of St. Teresa, and I lose myself. Sometimes it explodes my notions of order and conduct, much more than if it were objectionable.
He spoke with passion and authority, gesturing with his hand so vigorously that the boat rocked at one point, and I reached for the side to steady myself. It was almost as if I were experiencing the very thing he was trying to explain, this state of losing oneself. He said,
I know what you're saying, though, that you want your art to jolt people, to create an epiphany.
Yes, I said.
This is just my opinion, but I think the real jolt doesn't come because the art is objectionable or because it evokes social critique, but because the viewer becomes lost in the sheer beauty of it. It gives a person an experience of the eternal.
I couldn't speak. I was afraid, in fact, I might embarrass myself by crying, and I didn't even know why I felt the urge. It had been so long since I'd had a conversation like this. The boat had drifted on the anchor line to the edge of the water, where a brown, parched, dormant scent hovered in the grasses. He leaned back on his elbows against the rail, and the boat dipped a little. I said, "It sounds very mysterious."
What's that?
This experience of the eternal you mentioned. You're going to think I'm dense, but what is it exactly?
He smiled. No, I don't think you're dense. I hardly know what it is myself.
But you're a monk.
Yeah, but a weak, doubting one.
But you've had a lot of these eternal experiences, I can tell. And I don't have a clue what they are. I've spent most of my life being a mother and a wife, taking care of a house. When you said I was an artist, that's a stretch. I've only been puttering around with art. He squinted, fixing his eyes on something just above my shoulder.
When I first came here, he said, I had the impression that transcending the world was superior to simply being in it. I was always struggling to meditate, fast, detach, that kind of thing.
One day in the rookery, I realized that merely being out here, going about my work, was what made me the happiest. I finally figured out that what matters is just giving over to what you love. He turned to me. You've done that. I wouldn't worry too much about having eternal experiences. You can't manufacture them anyway. They're just little tastes of something timeless, a moment here and there when you're granted the bliss of stepping out of yourself. But I doubt they're more important than simply doing what you love. He reached over the side and grazed the water with his fingers. You were fortunate to grow up here. Well, I didn't think so for a long time. I stopped loving the island when I was 9. To be honest, it was only when I came back this time that I started to love it again. He leaned forward even farther. What happened when you were 9? Do you mind my asking? My father died in a boat fire. It was a fuel tank explosion. They said a spark from his pipe caused it. I closed my eyes, wanting to tell him how much of a daddy's girl I'd been. How when my father died, it was as if my whole childhood collapsed. The island changed for me after that. It turned into a kind of suffocating enclosure, I added. Sitting in the boat, I reached up unconsciously and touched the place on my skin where the priest always drew the ash in the shape of a cross. It felt like a dead spot. And mother, I went on. She changed. She used to be fun-loving, normal. But after he died, she became obsessively religious. It was like she left us too. He didn't say, "Oh, I'm sorry, how terrible," or any of those perfunctory things people said, but I glimpsed what struck me as sadness fill his eyes, as if a sorrowing place in him had recognized this same sorrowing place in me. I remember wondering what terrible thing might have happened to him. A flash of blue overhead, and I looked up to see a heron with a fish wriggling in its beak. The bird's shadow slid over the boat, passing between us. The thing was, I gave him the pipe for Father's Day, so I always felt like... I stopped. Like you'd caused it to happen, he said, finishing for me. I nodded. The funny thing is that I found the pipe in my mother's drawer the other day. She'd had it all this time. I forced a laugh, and it made a thin, bitter sound in the air. I didn't want to go into the questions about my father's death or the consequences of it, the gouged-out place inside me that I could not seem to fill up, and mother's long, dark slide. I wanted it to be the way it was a few moments before, when we'd talked about art, about the eternal. I did have a fleeting impulse to ask him about Father Dominic, what he thought of him, but I dismissed that too. I shifted my position on the boat seat, tucking one leg up under me. So tell me, I said, how long have you been here? He didn't answer right away. He seemed a little fazed by how abruptly I'd changed the subject. 4 years and 7 months, he said eventually. I'm to take my final vows in June. You mean you haven't done that yet? I'm what's called a simple professed monk. You spend 2 years as a novice, 3 as a simple professed, and then you decide whether you're going to stay forever. And then you decide. The words caused a commotion in me. I watched the wind lift the short ends of his hair. It shocked me how easy this was, how little conflict I felt inside, how enclosed we were in a world that seemed to have nothing to do with my life in Atlanta, with Hugh. I was actually sitting there, imagining a future with this man. What did you do before? I asked. I was a lawyer, he said, and for a split second, all the self-possession and assurance I sensed in him flared in his voice, in the intense look that passed through his eyes, in the forceful way he sat up straighter on the seat. I had a sudden sense that his former life had been one of great import, yet that was all he said about it. What made you give that up and come here? I'm not sure you want to know. It's a long, sad story. Well, I told you my long, sad story. I'd wondered what terrible thing had happened to him, but I hadn't imagined it would be as awful as it was. He told me about a wife named Linda, with fine blonde hair, and about their unborn baby whose nursery he'd painted the color of pumpkins because Linda craved pumpkin bread morning and night. They'd both died when a truck slammed into her car. Whit had been home at the time, putting the baby's crib together. He talked about them in a voice that changed perceptibly, the volume sinking so low that I had to tilt my body forward to hear him. His eyes trailed off, too, traveling back and forth between the floor of the boat and the place he'd focused on when he'd quoted the poem. Finally, looking at me, he said, "She called me before getting in the car that day to say she was sure we were having a girl. That's the last thing she said to me."
"I'm sorry," I told him. "I can understand why you'd come here."
"Everyone thinks I came here out of grief, because I was running away. I'm not sure if I was or not. I don't think so. I think mostly I was running toward something."
"You mean God?"
"I think I wanted to know whether there actually was one."
"And is there?"
He laughed like I'd made the ultimate joke, as if I would know. Even a weak, doubting monk must have some idea of that.
He was quiet a moment, watching a small egret fishing in the shallows at the edge of the water.
"Sometimes I experience God like this beautiful nothing," he said. "And it seems then as though the whole point of life is just to rest in it, to contemplate it and love it and eventually disappear into it. And then other times it's just the opposite. God feels like a presence that engorges everything. I come out here, and it seems the divine is running rampant, that the marsh, the whole of creation, is some dance God is doing, and we're meant to step into it. That's all. Do you know what I mean?" I told him I did, but that was mostly a lie. Still, I sat there with a rush of desire for his beautiful nothing, for his dance, but mostly for him. A cloud bloused across the sun, and the air dimmed around us. As we sat in the changing light, the tide bulged under the boat and bumped it against the reeds. It rocked like Moses' basket on the waters of Egypt. I became aware that he was staring straight at me. I could have turned away. I could have let it be another disposable moment in a whole lifetime of them. But I made a conscious decision to stare back, to let my gaze pierce the air like a blade and meet his. We stared a long time, perhaps a whole minute, our eyes fastened like that. There was an unspoken intention in it, a kind of fierceness. I was aware of my breath coming faster, that something exhilarating but dangerous was happening, that we were letting it happen, he as much as I. It became unbearable, finally. I had to look away. I think we could have been honest with each other right then and said what we were feeling. I believe we came very close. But the moment passed. The transparency of it hardened, and propriety set in.
"I'm sorry, it doesn't look as if the white pelicans are going to appear," he said. He glanced at his watch. "And I need to take you back so I can make my rounds through the rookery."
He began to pull on the anchor line. He nosed the boat through the little finger of water back into the creek, where he kicked the engine wide open. The noise from the motor filled my head. Looking back, I saw the white wake flow out behind us like the contrail of a jet. Whit, sitting there in his blue shirt, holding the rudder, big scallops of cloud overhead.
Then I saw them. The white pelicans were coming up behind us, flying low just above the water. I shouted, pointing up at them, and Whit turned the instant they rose sharply and sailed directly over us. They were drenched in light, the black tips of their wings gleaming. I counted 18 of them moving in their synchronized way in one single, dazzling line. Then they were gone.
After Whit tied the boat up at the dock, he offered me his hand as I stepped from the boat, and I took it. He squeezed before he let go. I thanked him for the ride. I left him standing on the dock. I could feel him watching me as I moved down the splintery planks of the walkway. When I reached the edge of the marsh, just before stepping into the silence of the trees, I looked back. What matters is giving over to what you love. Chapter 20. When we arrived at Max's cafe the following Saturday, Mother refused to go inside. She balked on the sidewalk like a spooked horse and wouldn't move. Cat, Benny, Hepzibah, and I tried to coax her to the door, but she was adamant. "Take me home," she said. "I mean it. Take me home." It had required all my tactics of persuasion, plus heavy-handed phone calls from Cat and Hepzibah both, to get her this far, and now it looked as if our well-